This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. As the COVID-19 vaccine continues to roll out throughout Indiana and eligibility expands to more individuals, there are still some people who are hesitant to get the shot, whether it's a two-dose or one-dose version. We'll hear from our guests today on why that is, and we'll also talk about how access may play a role and what can be done to address these issues. With us today, we have Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Public Health Department, Torian Everett, Vice President of Health Plan Operations and Community and Member Engagement at MD Wise, and Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, all of our guests today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
So I'd like to start with Dr. Kane. I just want to make sure you can hear me and I can hear you. How is distribution of the vaccine in Marion County working out so far?
We are considerably behind in terms of our vaccine distribution for our people of color based on the percentage of people that are here. For example, African Americans make up 28% of the population, and yet only 6.2% are vaccinated so far. If we look at our Latinx population, they make up nearly 9 or 10% of our population, and they're around about a little over about 4.5%. So when we compare ourselves to our white communities and community residents, we're a little bit further behind in our equitable distribution of our vaccines compared to our white counterparts. Now, could it be related to access? We know we have some vaccine hesitancy, but we've had more issues with people asking us, where can I get my vaccine? When can I get it? I'm ready. Then we're seeing the vaccine hesitancy.
What would you say the biggest challenge is in getting these vaccines out? Is it the number of doses available or just getting to these locations?
Number one, adequate vaccines, I think that's critical. That has been an issue in the past for us. But we seem to have now significant Pfizer and Moderna. Those are the two-shot version vaccines. But we have a significant number of African Americans say, I want that newest one, Johnson & Johnson, because it's a one-shot vaccine. And so at least for us in the health department arenas and some other sites, that's the one that's most difficult for us to acquire. But I do need to make the announcement that the Indiana Department of Health, in partnership with Indianapolis Motor Speedway, are going to have somewhere between 6 and 9 days where they are going to give the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, where you only have to take one vaccine and provide it. But that means you've got to have a car and be able to drive to Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So we're hoping we're going to be hosting some mobile unit hotspot vaccinations starting tomorrow with Eastern Star, where they're going to be vaccinated at Eastern Star Church within the next probably two weeks. We're going to do another sponsorship with Light of the World and four other churches, such as Witherspoon Presbyterian, Providence Church, New Era Church, where we're going to try to do a one-day vaccination, where we're going to try to vaccinate at least 1,000 people and try to have a choice of vaccines. So not just one. If you want another choice, we'll try to have more than one vaccine. But Johnson, you only take one shot and you're done with it. Pfizer, Moderna, you'll have to take two shots, and the second shot's got to come usually 21 days later or 28 days later.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned that for this Speedway vaccination site, people are going to have transportation, which I'd like to bring Torian into this. Can you explain what your organization MD Wise does and how that relates to transportation?
Yeah, so MD Wise is Indiana's only provider-sponsored health plan that serves Hoosier HealthWise and Healthy Indiana Plan members throughout the state of Indiana. So the Healthy Indiana Plan serves Hoosiers ages 19 through 64 and provides them coverage to low-income adults that are typically not eligible for Medicare or traditional Medicaid. And then the Hoosier HealthWise program is for children, where we provide coverage, where MDWise provides coverage to children up to age 19, as well as pregnant women. And we provide that medical care to them at little to no cost to the member or the member's family. So with the pandemic and providing transportation to the COVID vaccination sites, MDWise is doing outreach phone calls to the MDWise Hoosiers to educate them on the vaccine and to assist them with scheduling their vaccine appointment. We are sending email blasts, text blasts, just trying to do our part to help educate the community. And even with that, assisting in providing the transportation to those COVID vaccine sites. And right now, we actually are still pending an approval at the moment, but we're working to even be able to expand our transportation program and be able to provide transportation to Hoosiers throughout the state to a vaccination site that do not typically have a transportation benefit. So MDWise is very committed to doing our part to help bridge that gap of access.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Well, we'll talk more about access shortly, but I do want to dig in a little bit into this topic of vaccine hesitancy, because I think it's really come up in this last year with the virus and everything. This topic that people didn't really think about in terms of equity and access, especially when it comes to healthcare. Dr. Nephew, you wrote an article in January about overcoming your own hesitancy around the vaccine. Where did that hesitancy come from for you?
Hi, you know, I was surprised at myself that I had hesitancy. I'll preface by saying, you know, I've gotten all my previous vaccines. I've gotten the flu vaccine. I'm a clinician, a practicing clinician, and I always advise my patients to get vaccines. But in November and December, when the vaccine rolled out, I was nervous and I was almost embarrassed to be nervous, because there was this narrative that really only uneducated people had any hesitancy around the vaccine. And when I talked to my colleagues and my friends, women of color who are physicians, there were many of us who had a little bit of nervousness and were a little bit unsure. And so when I wrote that article, I really wanted to kind of dispel this myth that only uneducated people and you were only unthoughtful people were somehow nervous about the vaccine. And I think that the hesitancy stems certainly from historical transgressions of the medical society against brown and black bodies. Certainly the U.S. Public Service experiment on black men in Tuskegee, Alabama is often cited as an example. But I think more contemporary and current lived experiences also make people hesitant around getting the vaccine. And so I really want to kind of step away from this idea that there were only things that were happening in the past. There's a lot for us in the medical community to reckon with that is happening now in terms of disparities and racism and disparities in access. And so for me, I think my own lived experience made me a little bit nervous. The speed by which the vaccine was developed made me a little nervous as a scientist. And so I had to delve into that and begin to understand that. I wanted some messengers that I could relate to. And so I think, you know, who gives the message about the vaccine is important. And so I sought out some colleagues in infectious disease who were colleagues of color that I felt like I could trust. So I think when we are trying to overcome hesitancy, it's important that we listen to people's reasons for why they're hesitant, because they're real and they're valid response to things that are happening in our current society. And we find messengers that they can trust and we provide them with information. For me as a scientist, I really needed to kind of read the trials. And so I pulled out the table ones and I looked at all the, you know, epidemiology, you know, and looked at all the efficacy rates. And people may not want to go that deep, but they do want reliable information. And so I think hesitancy is rooted in some lack of information, lack of trusted messengers, and then just ongoing distrust in the medical community. And I think you can have hesitancy and difficulty with access. They can coexist. It's not one or the other. There's some folks who are hesitant, and there's lots of problems with access, and we should be able to help try to deal with both issues, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Tuskegee syphilis study, and I've heard that cited a lot in this past year with hesitancy towards the vaccine. Do you hear that as a reason often from patients who don't want to get vaccinated, or is it a myriad of things?
I don't. You know, it's funny that I think it comes up in a lot of academic settings, but when I'm talking to my patients every day, people just say they don't trust it. And it may be, maybe it's rooted in that. Maybe it's rooted in conversations they've had at home with their family members and their older family members. They remember that. The last patient that was enrolled in that study was 1972. So this is not something that happened 100 years ago. So there certainly is a memory and a footprint. But I think many people just have ongoing current experience, lived current experiences that make them nervous and make them want to have more information and to step cautiously. And then there's a lot of my patients who are just ready to get it and just want to know how and don't have internet access or don't have the time to keep trying to enroll through the internet. And the internet, you know, sign up is difficult, maybe moving slowly. So I think there's hesitancy and then there's access issues. And I think some of it perhaps is rooted in past, but I think most of it's rooted in current people's current experiences and their current kind of fears.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, there's a line that you wrote that was very powerful that let me pull it up real quick, that the racial disparity in COVID-19 mortality has nothing to do with race and everything to do with structural racism. And I want to delve into that a little bit more. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be discussing more about vaccine hesitancy. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about vaccine hesitancy and vaccine access issues in Indiana. With us today, we have Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Public Health Department, Torian Everett, Vice President of Health Plan Operations and Community and Member Engagement at MD Wise, and Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Before the break, we left off talking about Dr. Nephew's recent article on her own vaccine hesitancy. And I mentioned this line that you had in your article, that the racial disparity in COVID-19 mortality has nothing to do with race and everything to do with structural racism. Do you think there's been a shift in the general public's perception of structural racism by seeing firsthand how the virus has been affecting communities of color?
I hope that there's been a shift. I felt early in the pandemic there was a narrative about comorbidity and that, you know, if you were obese and you had hypertension and diabetes, which are higher prevalence in Black communities, that that's why you were getting COVID. And there, I felt there was almost this kind of under hint of blame. And so I studied racial disparities in liver cancer and access to transplant. And I think many of the concepts and disparities research and disparities in general just cross over. And it's not that's not the end of the story, obesity, hypertension, and diabetes. It's how did we get there? And certainly, if you back up into the cascade, into the laws and policies that affect Brown and Black people differently, and how unmet social needs that are a downtrend or a result of those laws and policies. So lack of access to good education, lack of access to good jobs, housing discrimination, those things have consequences. And those consequences are often obesity and hypertension. And that may predispose you to COVID. But those things didn't just happen necessarily all because of biology. There's systemic racism and laws and things that led up to those things. And so I thought it important to think about that. And I think we've seen the system, this is more evident here in the COVID pandemic than ever before.
So I would, can I pipe in a little bit here?
Please.
Oh, can you hear me? So
yes.
I think people really need to have a little bit better, just the general public, have a little bit better understanding what it means by structural racism. And, you know, sometimes people will say it's a structure and just the people inside are racist. And so that's not really structural racism. And just to give an example, you know, people are looking for, I'm going to rent an apartment. So I may go to a very nice apartment complex and be told, if I'm black, well, we really don't, we have very few places for you to rent here. And when I'm renting, they will give a black a higher rent payment model so that you got to pay way more money even to rent here otherwise. And then someone who might be white can come in. I got plenty of places for you to rent, and I got all this discount. The other has to do with, you know, how do we build businesses? How do we have economy? Well, sometimes we need to go to the bank and get a bank loan. And you know how many blacks are able to get a good bank loan? Maybe to their white counterparts. Let's talk about, I'll just give you the example, the big stimulus package. The first stimulus package, hardly any money went to a lot of black businesses because most of the, a significant number of the banks who had relationships with white institutions got on the call personally and told them, hey, we got this money. You can apply for this, okay? And how many of our banking institutions are doing that with our black residents, businesses, and they may be located in areas of poverty that we can't get our ability to get a mortgage, you know, in terms of disparity. So we're so far sometimes behind the eight ball. And my last thing, hey, inflation. What is the minimum wage? $7.25. Is something wrong when I have to access health care based on how much money I got, whether I can afford it versus this is my need? So how many of us black don't have access? That means how many states in the United States don't have an extended insurance for you to get care? So this is what I talk about from structural racism. Look at the number of CEOs in 500 companies. Now, you're trying to say that there are not many of us because maybe we're not smart. Well, maybe we don't have access from a ladder promotion because we may not function in the same social networks. So that's what's considered structural racism. My father was in World War II. He was supposed to be able to get a home mortgage. And a lot of the blacks that graduated from the war and were eligible, they didn't get those home mortgages, but the white soldiers did. So, you know, we started a long time ago being behind for a significant number of our populations. Public school funding, you get property taxes. So if a lot of low income money that you get from property taxes, but it goes to public schools, you get less money to put in those schools. So this is the inequity I want us to realize.
And I appreciate you sharing that. I think what I'm wondering is, do you see any shift at all, even the tiniest shift, with what happened with COVID and vaccines and access and all this? Was there any shift, do you think, in the general public's mind that there's something deeper going on? And any one of you, feel free to answer.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be so vocal. But I honestly think that I want to say George Floyd really turned the tide for everybody, really getting the attention about the discrepancy in how people of color may be treated compared to their white counterparts. And it's just, you know, it's like it's that invisible thing. I didn't even know what I didn't know, but it has brought so much attention to this, not only just in law enforcement, education, and, you know, the care that we get, you know, and sometimes people have implicit biases and we may realize that. But the other person doesn't realize that they're doing anything wrong. And they think they're doing a fantastic job. So I'm a young mother. You know, I've got to go to my doctor's appointment. But I'm on the bus, and I got two little kids with me. I make it to my appointment. But guess what? I made it to my appointment 16 minutes late. And at 15 minutes is the cutoff, I got to reschedule you. Now, So we have some systems that kind of work more for the system than we're having a system that works for the patient, okay? And so, you know, it took me about 45 minutes, an hour to get here, and I'm a minute late, and you're telling me I have to reschedule? So is that the kind of system where we may need to have some flexibility built in here based on our population and what their needs are? So this is what I'm trying to kind of get at here, but I think people, their eyes are opening. They're seeing this, and I know this is for the fact. I have my colleagues tell me in so many different areas of industry, schools, and whatever. I think we're finally opening our eyes.
Well, Dr. Kane, I think that you just kind of walked us into another place in the conversation about looking at social determinants of health as a whole. When you look at people who are malnourished and people who do not get that access to a well visit or a dental cleaning, and, you know, from an oral health perspective, you know, I think that where you were just going with that, you really just walked us into highlighting just how much transportation alone impacts that access. And so I think that we all have, you know, we have that responsibility to work to try to bridge those gaps as best as we can through the various programs and through various partnerships with the provider community. And, you know, to your point, I've experienced being that 16 minutes late, you know, and fortunately I do have a vehicle, and still, whether it was traffic or whatever happened, experienced being that 16 minutes late and was told that I have to reschedule. And so, you know, when we look at that child who needs their immunizations and that child that needs their lead test and, you know, things like that, we're preventing them from having that access to that care. And so I think when we go beyond looking at just the pandemic, it started well before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Dr. Kane, I believe that the pandemic has just begun to highlight those different situations are.
Yes, exactly.
And I think people are beginning to see that pathway of just, as Dr. Kane described, systemic racism, the laws and policies like getting housing loans, and how that trickles down to poor social determinants like getting a ride to work getting a ride to appointments, and then how that trickles down to poor health. So all of these things are interrelated, and they didn't start, at COVID, but they certainly have been highlighted. And I do believe people's eyes are somewhat opened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to just kind of bringing this back a little bit to the vaccines, and you guys are mentioning the access just overall for healthcare in general, but also when it comes to this sort of, like, right now in this moment, this is something that we're hoping people can get vaccinated and we can squash this virus. I mean, what are some of the sort of solutions to getting to that step where we can make sure that people are being able to have this choice to get vaccinated and actually get to a vaccine center?
Well, from an MDY's perspective, we definitely recognize the impacts of people, as Dr. Neffy mentioned earlier, not wanting to sit on the internet or the system is moving slow or don't have the internet access to be able to go to the website. And unfortunately, just due to the call volume to 211, the wait times are mm-hmm. so long and busy and things like that. So from an MDY's perspective, as we're making those outreach calls to our members to inform them about the vaccine and schedule them for the appointment, if there's someone else that's there in their house that wants to be scheduled for the vaccine, you know, while we would love for them to be an MDWISE member, it's not about if they're a member or not. If we have that person there, they're eligible for the vaccine, we are even doing our part in going ahead and scheduling them for that vaccine, if that's what's going to help bridge that gap in them being able to have that choice to get the vaccine. Now, mm-hmm. I do know from some feedback, we have people who wanted the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because, as Dr. Kane spoke about earlier, it is the one dose and you're done versus needing to go back. When we get back into transportation, you know, it all mm-hmm. goes back. I may have been able to get there one time, but am I sure that I'm going to have the ability to be able to get back there a second time
and get during that window
and get childcare
off of work? And, yeah. You know, it's just, it's never ending for people.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and if the vaccine site is only open during the daytime, to your point, Dr. Nephew, about someone needing to take off of work, you know, now you're turning around and you're impacting them even further because now you're taking money away from them to be able to provide for their family.
Mm-hmm. And then what about the experience of like where you get one vaccine and then the second one is in a completely separate location, maybe 20 miles from where you got the first one? That also creates a hurdle for folks to overcome. Dr. Kane, I wanted to ask you, you know, Governor Holcomb is expanding eligibility to the vaccine at the end of the month to 16 years of age and up. Does that complicate things even further and push folks back who need to get the vaccine and are now it's just going to be one more thing in the way for them?
I think the answer is going to relate to how much vaccine we're going to be able to access for the federal government. So if we can access sufficient vaccine, I think we have the infrastructure and the capacity to be able to handle everybody. We need to finally get this vaccine into our private doctor's offices. And so that's the boots of folks who are well experienced in giving immunizations that we have not had access to because we haven't had ample vaccine. But if we can make that happen, I think that would just be tremendous. And we mm-hmm. have a really great group of Medical Reserve Corps individuals, physicians who are retired, or some of them working part-time. We've got all these wonderful schools of nursing, schools of pharmacy, dental schools, along with our traditional medical schools here, IU and Marion University. So we've got a whole group of additional healthcare professionals that can help us do the vaccinations. So I think the capacity is here. It's just getting sufficient vaccine in order to use it. And don't forget, we were hampered with one of the vaccines because one of the vaccines required you to have this ultra cold storage unit, minus 98 degrees, and those storage units started out at about $60,000 a cost. So you don't have those kind of units in a private doctor's office, but only hospitals initially had it, or some big businesses, probably Lilly or Roche or some of those guys may have it, but we didn't have it in our local health departments. So we finally bought one, but it took us 3 to 4 months, you know, because everybody's trying to buy everything before we even got it here for our local health department. But those are expensive items.
And so Dr. Nephew, are you at all?
Question or not, but I think we can handle it if they get that vaccine to us.
Yeah, no, that was a great answer. Dr. Nephew, are you worried at all about your patients being able to access this vaccine now that the eligibility has widened?
You know, I'm excited about the eligibility widening. I wanted that to happen. And people, as long as they're signed up to get it, even if it's 6 weeks from now, that's okay with me. So many of my patients were in their 30s and 40s and really have comorbidities and liver disease. It puts them in increased risk for poor outcomes from COVID. And they really wanted to have access. I really wanted them to have access. So I'm happy about the expansion. As long as people, you know, can get in line to get signed up, I'm happy. And they may not be able to get it next week, But I think opening the eligibility to everyone is a good idea at this point. I do.
All right. Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about why there is still some hesitancy around the COVID-19 vaccine, what impact it seems to be having, and what can be done about it. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on vaccine hesitancy. We're talking about why some people are still hesitant to get vaccinated and what effect it's having on communities in Indiana. With us is Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Health Department, Torion Everett, Vice President of Health Plan Operations and Community and Member Engagement at MD Wise, and Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Nephew, I want to get back to this article that you wrote. You mentioned your hesitancy and then how, you know, as just a researcher and a medical professional, you also had to see the facts for yourself. What ultimately gave you comfort in just saying, you know what, I'm going to do it?
There were a few things. You know, the inclusiveness of these trials was really important for me. I review clinical trials. I get asked to review research studies, and there's often significant underrepresentation of minorities in these trials. And I was really pleased to see that the Moderna and Pfizer trials had 10% Black participation and more than that for Latinx participation. And so that was important to me. I wanted to know that there were people who looked like me who had comorbidities like people in my family who received the vaccine. So the representation, I think, helped me actually looking at kind of the outcomes. We don't get very many vaccines that are 90%+ effective. And so it's really an amazing feat of science to have that high a rate of protection. And so when I was able to look at the trials for myself and see this is actually true, they actually really did achieve 94% and 95% effectiveness. That also gave me comfort. And then when I looked at the side effect profile, while there certainly are a number of kind of immune response side effects that people get, so that kind of, you know, those side effects that let you know your immune system is working, like muscle aches and arm soreness and some fever, there was no death. and that was important to me because we're talking about COVID, where one in 645 Black people in the United States have died. Okay. So when you're weighing your likelihood of death from COVID to your likelihood of death from this vaccine, and there's been zero deaths in the trials, I thought that was promising. And so I needed to see it for myself. And so seeing it on paper, you know, printed out on my desk helped me. So getting the facts helped. And then I have an infectious disease colleague who I trained with in fellowship, and I called him up and I said, talk to me about this mRNA technology. I haven't thought about this since medical school. And so he walked me through it, and I said, okay, I feel comfortable with that. So I think, and he was somebody I trusted. So again, I think people want information, and they want information from people that they trust. And mm-hmm. so those were things that helped kind of move me forward. And then I asked him, I said, how did they get this done so quickly? Because I can't seem to get any of my science done this quickly. And, you know, he said, well, Lauren, you know, vaccines go through kind of a phase 1, 2, and 3. And he said they didn't skip any phases. But what they did do is that they had money to be able to develop the clinical trial sites for phase 3 while phase 1 was happening. It doesn't make a lot of sense for drug companies to invest in phase 3 before they know that phase 1 is done. But this was a unique scenario where there was an immediate need and the money was available to do that. And so they were able to work on things simultaneously in a way that hadn't been done before. They also share data around the world in a way that scientists often don't. And so that eased some of my concerns about how fast the vaccine was developed. And so, like I said, getting some information from people I trusted, reading the data for myself, and really just reckoning with the significant mortality rate in my population and in people that I know. A good friend of my family was very well, had an asthma attack in her house and died of COVID. And so just the reality of people around me dying from this disease, I watched people in the hospital dying without loved ones on a regular basis. And it just, those things, so the reality, information, trusted folks, I said, okay, Lauren, you can't delay this. I knew I get it, but you can't push this off. You need to get this now. And so I got my first vaccine and as soon as I was able to in December.
Mm-hmm. And what you know, would you say go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say to Dr. Nephew's point there, trust, I believe, plays a huge factor, especially for people of color, Black, Latino, X, trust matters. And just, you know, speaking from my own experience, I had hesitancy myself. And again, it came back to trust. And so, while I'm not a clinician, so I didn't, you know, have the medical piece to go with it, my research was watching people like me and seeing what their experiences were and how they responded to the vaccine. And even with my own mother, when she found out that I just randomly called her when I was coming from getting my second dose. And I was like, yeah, I just came from getting my second dose of the vaccine. And she was so surprised. And she was like, you know, why did you do that? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Aren't you going to do it? But again, it came for her trust in getting the vaccine, which she has received her first dose, came from having a conversation with me sharing with her that I didn't experience any side effects. However, there are people that I do know, to Dr. Nephew's point, that experience those immune reactions, such as the aches and things like that. But the people that I know, it only lasts for about a day. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. And so really, this whole thing, I think, goes back to trust. Goes back to making sure that we push the education out to the community. And that's a part of what even led us here today with this conversation, where MDWISE has partnered with Eskenazi Health and the Marion County Public Health Department to put on a webinar Q&A event to take the fight to COVID. And if I may, that event will be on April 7th. And Hoosiers can learn more about that through going to mdwise.org/IndyFightsCOVID to learn the information about how to attend that webinar. We are doing – MDWISE is doing that for the state of Indiana. It's not about specifically an MDWISE member. We do have Dr. Kane, who is going to be one of our panelists that day. So we're very grateful to have her participation. And we'll have Dr. Crabb, who's the chief medical officer from Eskenazi Health. And then we'll also have Dr. Randall Taylor, who's a clinical pharmacist that is a part of McLaren Health, which is MDWISE's parent company. He will be on the panel as well, along with myself, just to continue to push the information to the community. It was very important for us to ensure that targeting the Black community and Latinx community was to ensure that the panel looked like the people we were trying to reach as much as possible. You know, we did our best to achieve that. That event will even be moderated by Tina Cosby of Radio One, just so that we could really try to push that information to the state further.
So we've talked about
can I add just one really important point?
Sure.
You know, everybody's been in an accident and, you know, sometimes have had to require a blood transfusion. And a lot of people are not aware that a Black scientist, Dr. Charles Drew, was the one who discovered plasma. We wouldn't have blood transfusions at all in this hospital or anywhere without the discovery of that by a Black physician. And we have a young lady who's the leading scientist, Dr. Kamikia Corbett. She's the last scientist in Anthony Fauci's institution at NIH that helped to develop the Moderna vaccine. So we've got some people of color from our communities who are with their mission of their love for public service are actually the ones who are helping to develop the vaccine, and some wonderful things are happening. And we want to make sure we're giving credit to her and all the incredible work she's done for years, being at NIH almost 10 years now. And I love to tell people that. So that's why I trust this vaccine. But I also know 47 million people have been given this vaccine, and so far we have not officially had one person die from the vaccine. 47 million. But I want y'all to learn about what's a long hauler for COVID-19. A long hauler is someone who has COVID-19, and they have major chronic symptoms for weeks and months, like brain fog, chronic fatigue syndrome. You may have inflammation of your lungs or your heart that can cause long-term complications. Women, you can lose hair loss. So there's so many incredible things we need to learn and understand in making our decision about this vaccine.
And you know, we've talked about education, trust, representation, knowing that there are people like you that are taking this vaccine and they're still alive. What about the fact that, you know, there could be folks who you're telling them all of this stuff, but they log on to social media and something convinces them otherwise? How much of a role are things online playing in giving people hesitancy, maybe?
There's certainly.
Oh, no, go ahead, Dr. Nephew.
There's definitely a lot of misinformation out there. And I have challenged all of my colleagues. You know, I'm a gastroenterologist, and sometimes we leave vaccination discussions to our primary care providers. And I've challenged everyone to bring up the vaccine with their patients when they see them. All of us can ask, do you have any questions about the vaccine? That doesn't mean I'm pushing an agenda. It doesn't mean I'm trying to get you to get the vaccine. I just want to know, do you have any questions that I can answer about the vaccine? And I've heard so much misinformation by asking that one simple question. And so I don't ask anybody, I don't tell anyone you should get the vaccine. I don't say, unless they ask me, but I just try to open with that open-ended question. What have you heard about the vaccine, and do you have any questions? And I've gotten back a lot of misinformation, and I try to take that opportunity to redirect people and to give them reliable information. So there's certainly a lot of misinformation out there on social media. So we have a big job to do to correct that and provide people with reliable sources.
And I love what Dr. Nephew is saying. What is she saying? That it is that person's right to make their own personal choice about whether they're going to get vaccinated or not. I'm not your parent. You know, I'm not your mother. You know, you're smart enough when you can understand the facts, learn about things, to make your own personal decision. And it's your own responsibility to decide if getting vaccination is for you. So in your decision-making process, we got to always respect that person's feelings, their level of understanding, and their comfort level about whether getting vaccinated is for them.
Yeah. And Dr. Kane, I think definitely to add one point to what you were saying, you know, I'm glad that we're acknowledging that people have the concerns about the vaccine, but I think that's also why it's so important for us to ensure that we're talking about it and that we're making sure that we're giving people the facts as we know them today and pointing them to the information. Because one thing about social media can do a lot of good or it can do a lot of damage. And just this morning alone, on my Facebook timeline, I seen someone post about you know, that the vaccine is, and all the people that's running to get it, they're brainwashed, and, you know, they took us from being enslaved physically to now it's mentally, and, you know, all of this. And while everyone is entitled to their own opinion, I just think that we have a social responsibility to ensure that we're getting the information out. Now, people are going to do what people are going to do. However, are we doing our part to bridge the gaps so that if people do want it, we're affording them that opportunity? And are we ensuring that we're providing people the necessary information that they're looking
for? Give them the tools in order
to
enhance their education.
Yes.
And I think that's so important. And I think there's a narrative that hesitancy is a big problem in the Black community, and it's certainly something to be addressed. But the Kaiser Foundation survey suggests that over 70% of Black people want to be vaccinated. And so people just need access and information. And yes, I want to tackle that 30% of folks who were nervous, like me too. But people need to know that people are out here getting vaccinated of color. So don't necessarily buy into the few people that you may hear about on social media, because most people of color are getting vaccinated, trying to get vaccinated, trying to sign up. And so we just have to get them there. And we also have to provide the right information so that people who were a bit nervous can make an educated decision.
Mm-hmm. And this vaccine does not give you COVID-19.
Yes,
it does not give you COVID-19, and it does not alter your DNA, your genetic makeup. You will be the same person you were before the vaccine as well as after the vaccine. So if anyone wanted a new personality or a new social skills from after this vaccine, I'm going to hate to disappoint you.
And it doesn't cause infertility. One of the common things I hear among my young men, women, is does it cause infertility? 23 women in a Pfizer vaccine trial got pregnant because there's not a lot to do during COVID and people get pregnant, okay? And this idea that the protein that your antibodies are making against COVID is the same as the protein on the placenta is not true. It's just not true. These proteins are very specific, and there's a specific phone number, and the phone number on the placenta is not the same. And even if it was only one digit difference, one digit difference is a bit different phone number. Okay. So it's not the same as the protein on the placenta. And I get that question so much. And so this was a myth. It's not true. We don't even, it's just not true. So fertility is not an issue.
I think we could do a whole show just breaking down a lot of the myths and things that go around on WhatsApp and Instagram and all of that. Well, I want to take the time and thank all of you for joining us this afternoon. It's been a great pleasure to have you on. Dr. Virginia Kane is director of the Marion County Public Health Department. Torian Everett, vice president of health plan operations and community and member engagement at MDWISE. And Dr. Lauren Nephew, assistant professor of medicine in the division of gastroenterology and hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Our producers, Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. And Christopher Flood filled in as our engineer today. Join us tomorrow as we talk about the pandemic 1 year later. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.